Practices Commission. And do I need to turn it over to you, Darren, first?
Real quick.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Darren Hill, and then we're going to have Vicki Chamberlain. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have a couple of handouts that are in front of you. What I have done is what I usually do, which is try to cover the situation since the legislature last heard this budget. They had one emergency board request. They came in and were asking for, it started out as a $120,000 request. It ended up being a $220,000 request. But fortunately, they have taken care, and I've listed the factors out here. I won't spend a lot of time on them. I know we're in kind of a hurry today. But they have actually not requested that additional $100,000 be rescheduled yet. And so they've taken some actions. It'll come out kind of what the issues are around their caseloads and those kinds of things as we have the discussion today. I also listed the performance measures in here, a couple of other issues, again, mainly dealing with caseloads and kind of some office space issues that they've got. But I've also given you a copy of my my analysis of the governor's budget. And with that, I'll just turn it over and let Ms. Chamberlain take it from there.
Great. Thank you very much. Ms. Chamberlain, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Galizio. I'm wondering about the need to do the review since no one's here. I don't know what your thoughts on that are. I can go through these slides extremely quickly, just to refresh your memory. Would that work for you?
Yes. I mean, I think probably the most important is I would just go over that which you think we absolutely
need to know
at this point.
Just move on through. I like to remind folks these are the three primary areas that the commission operates under. We do the licensure and program approval for higher ed and the professional practices or discipline. So that's how we have organized our presentation to you. Just as a matter of information, in the licensure area, which is the biggest part of our operation, the handout I gave you is actually the list of active licenses we have. And the way it's set up, you can see we've categorized it by the major categories of licenses. So as of just an hour ago when I printed this, we had 4,300 administrators. And if you flip to the back, we have 59,865 active teaching licenses right now. And the grand total, that's active licenses, but that is not headcount. The headcount turns out to be closer to about 62,500 because some people possess two licenses. I may be a teacher with an administrator license, or I may be a teacher with a school counselor license or something similar. It's almost always something that results in that. But it's not, as you can see, 62,000 to 66. It's not a big part of the population. And I will point out that the way I divided licensure here is we license the teachers, the administrators, school counselors, and school psychologists. We register the charter school folks, and then we certify the school nurses. And I know that seems a little odd, but that's how they roll out. The program approval area, when I came here in January, there were 20 either colleges or universities in higher ed that offer programs in licensure areas, teaching and administration, counseling, and school psychology. And we routinely visit these folks to approve their programs and accredit them. New programs get accredited 5 years after they first come to the commission, and other programs are reviewed every 7 years. In the professional practices or discipline, this is sort of a professional move. Instead of calling it discipline, the National Committee calls it professional practices. And this is a summary of the reports, 214 reports. And this is a big area in terms of our budget requests and package this time because we've been falling behind. I brought the committee this long piece of paper to give you the data on what is going on. And let me help you understand it because it took me a while, even after I had this job, to understand the data on here. The very top few lines are last year as of December. And to give you an idea. So when you look, those are the commission meeting dates. Those are the only times that any kind of discipline action can happen is at a commission meeting. If you go to orders and actions, those are that would be an order that the commission entered against an educator. So over the course of 2006, they entered 91. If you go to charge, that means out of the cases that the commission reviewed, they charged 11 folks with violations. And then and that's a little bit misleading because some folks can get charged, but they'll get settled into an order there in that 91. And then you'll see here under investigation reports it says dismiss and no further actions. That's how we keep track between districts and patron complaints. So if it's a dismissal column, that means it was a report from the district. And if it's an, I misspoke, if it's a dismissal column, that's a complaint from a patron. If it's a no further action, that's a report from a district. And we just split it up that way so that we have an easy way to keep track of the data. But if you'll see, they're about even then, based on where the complaint came from. And then whether to reinstate, issue, or deny, there are only three. The rules are that only the commission can reinstate a revoked license. And very few people whose licenses are revoked ask to have them reinstated. So those numbers are generally, if you look down all the way down across the years, it's sort of rare that somebody asks for that to happen. And then the right-hand side of the page is the pending and the new cases sort of as they come up relative to meetings. So if you go to the far right column where it says total new cases and you'll see 214, if you scroll down to the very bottom in 98, we had 81 cases. So we're about 250% more than we were. And so that's kind of interesting and phenomenal.
And any idea as to why or...
I do have an idea as to why. I think, first of all, I don't think educators are getting worse. I think that the tolerance for some behavior is different in some regards. And we have way more educators than we do positions for hire. There isn't in Oregon there isn't really a teacher shortage, at least in the higher population areas, and there isn't a need to keep an educator who has really misbehaved badly. And so I think that districts are getting more and more to the stage where they won't tolerate behavior as much as they used to, and that's okay too, I think, in some regards. But if you look, out of the 195 cases, almost half of them were dismissed. So we still haven't balanced out the number. There's a high reporting. The statute requires us to investigate every case, but only in about half of the cases is there really evidence that anybody has done anything wrong. And that seems to be consistent, actually, across the years. So I don't have a solution for that, other than we're required to look at them and investigate all of them. So I thought this might be some interesting information for you to have. These are our budget drivers. In the licensure area, it's almost all around customer service, and that is the speed that we issue them, the speed that we respond to people who have questions about their licenses, the quality of the information that they're getting from our staff, and how easy it is for them to get a license. Obviously, there's a demand for faster service. I think that's a function of society somewhat. People used to be satisfied with waiting for 30 days to get their license, and now that's just the urgency that I'm sensing from people who contact our office, I think, is very proportionate to the changes I see in society. They want someone to talk to now, they want an answer to their email now, and they want their license now, and we're trying to get closer to now, but and it is significantly better than when I arrived here 5 years ago. Program approval, our budget drivers here are the, as technology improves and data improves, institutions, rightfully so, want data from us about where are their graduates going? Are they getting jobs? And we've only just been able to collect this kind of data, and I think I moved ahead a little too fast. So we're gearing up, actually, for how we're going to be able to be responsive to them to provide those type of reports. Then in the professional practices area, obviously, or not, we as the number of reports in our office exceed our capacity to investigate them, our backlog grows, and that means we're getting slower and slower in terms of when it first comes in the office and we get it out the door. So our goal right now, we are still not exceeding the number of cases we can investigate and dispose of at each commission meeting. The number of complaints that come in that interval between commission meetings is still exceeding the number of cases that we can investigate and dispose of at this moment. So that obviously is something we need to fix before it becomes worse. Any questions about the general part? All right. Our performance measures were reviewed by the Legislative Audit Committee last July, so they're not even a year old. And I know that Darren has made a recommendation. When we started out doing this, we had several that weren't measurable and really didn't tell us much. So we have asked for a few of those to be deleted. And actually, I'm quite pleased with our performance measures right now because I think they're measuring real areas in our agency. And for the first time, we've been able to collect real good, valid quality data to measure them. We based our targets on our ability to perform, and we think that it's actually been able to feed us back information that's been helpful in terms of making adjustments with staff. And our budget packages were aimed exactly at improving our customer service. So I put the information on the performance measures in the back of the notebook where I was asked to do it, and I also gave you a new copy of the performance measure information that was included in our governor's recommended budget because Darren caught that we had a couple of holes in our information and our data, so I updated those. If we prioritize our programs and services, our ability to issue licenses and get them out the door quickly would be our top priority, and our ability to respond, as I mentioned earlier, and respond in a high-quality way. And for program approval, this is actually becoming more and more interesting. The demand for knowledge of knowing that higher ed is doing a good job and the jobs that they're doing in preparing educators is becoming higher. And the federal government about 4 years or 5 years ago asked for us to make a report for what was the status of people who are coming out of teacher education programs, how are they doing, and so we do that annually, and that report has fed new data into our office. So that report is due annually under the Higher Ed Act. And it's our job to monitor and approve programs before they recommend them for licensure. So we have one person in our office who handles this. We have one person who organizes them, one person who puts the site teams together, one person who writes the reports, and that person also happens to be my deputy who supports me when I'm gone. So it's a smallly staffed area. Oh, you know, I do want to point out, too, this is the area where we monitor our licensure tests and how relevant they are to the endorsements that we have on licenses and the standards for those programs. And then, once again, professional practices. Our key area here is to reduce our backlog and our caseload. And also, we've noticed that we're having a higher and higher demand of requests to go out to districts and talk to people about the actual ethics. So a new move for the agency is we're adopting a new administrator preparation test, and included in the administrator preparation test is going to be a portion on Oregon educator ethics. It's actually be the first test in the nation that will have that. And it's our belief that if the district leadership is very aware of the ethical requirements, they'll be able to do a better job of advising staff, dealing with issues, and discerning when something ought to come to our agency. So that takes me to our first policy package. Oops, I just sped right by it. All right. Our first policy package is a request to add an additional investigator and one support staff. Right now we have 1.5 investigators for a position, and I have averaged out the number of cases that our investigators are getting done, and so if there was one more full-time position, it would add 50 to 80 more cases a year. This is this would significantly reduce our backlog. And I put this in, this is sort of how it works right now. My executive assistant actually is here, Melody. She is in charge of keeping all the data and the stats in the organization around professional practices or discipline. And she right now oversees the assignment of the cases to the current 1.5 investigators that we have. And she also supervises the one investigative assistant who writes investigation reports and writes the orders and handles that workload. What we're proposing is when we add this new position is we're going to, this is actually my attempt to reduce my AG fees. If we can hire at the higher level, an investigator 3 level, we can hire somebody who has a legal background. Our AG fees multiplied almost 50% over the biennium. And that is because if we give a notice to an educator about a case, it has to be written properly. The charges have to be laid out properly. If we settle with an educator, the order to settle with them has to be written properly. If we go to the administrative law judges for a hearing, if an educator is appealed, then the attorney has to represent us there, so we're paying trial wages, so to speak, and then the attorney has to write the order. So, and then finally, the other area that actually was capturing a lot of our investigators' time is that our investigators would do the investigation, and then they, the investigator, would negotiate with the defense attorney for any possible settlement if they found evidence that an educator had violated. That takes a lot of time, connecting on the phone, negotiating those cases. So we took a look at it and figured out that if all the investigators did was investigate, that they could fact find and go do that on many more cases if one person in the office is doing the full time negotiating with the educator and the defense attorneys that these educators have. And then that one person would be the person who would also be the liaison with the AG's office instead of 3 people being the liaison with the AG's office. I can tell you I hired a temp person to try this out for the last month, and my AG is very, very happy about it. It has taken a lot off of his plate. He actually represents 4 other agencies. So I honestly believe this is going to assist us in reducing our AG fees significantly, and I'm very excited about it, actually. It's an evolution for us in our office. So that is the proposal for the use of the new position. Now, if you want me to go over this, I will, but this is a very detailed flowchart of exactly what happens to a complaint when it comes in our office. And I just thought, I don't know if anybody's ever gone through that with you, but this is exactly what happens in terms of it comes in the office, it gets assigned to an investigator. There are a lot of things that can hold up that investigation, including if the educator's been criminally charged or if related to an employment issue, they may go to the Fair Dismissal Board, or all kinds of things like that. And then if we're able to conclude our report because there isn't anything else pending, then if there's evidence that they have violated ethics, we have an opportunity to negotiate a settlement with them before we take it to the commission. But by the way the statutes are written, it's my job as the director to recommend to the commission what to do with this investigation report. So that has put me in an interesting position because I don't look at any of the cases until they're done. I don't want to be influenced in the middle. And so that's in the middle here. And so I'm the one who recommends to the commission we should dismiss this case or take no further action or charge them. And the commission doesn't always agree with me. And it's a very, very valid process, in my opinion, about how this works. But the point I'm making here is that the investigators don't recommend to the commission, or no one else recommends to the commission. We have sort of a neutral party who recommends to the commission. Do you have a question? No. Thank you. So, moving on, then, these gray boxes are areas where we discovered we could use internal staff to do work that in the past the AG has done. And so this is where we think we can save time and money. Any questions about the discipline package? Our next package is related to the technology in the office, which is at the core and the heart of our ability to provide customer service. And I think it was the belief of folks when I first came in the office that the technician that we had been contracting with to redo our systems to help us do applications online and to create our online system would just come in and build it and then would leave. And what we discovered is that's not what happens with these systems. They're constantly evolving, you're finding new ways to do things, or there's constantly new needs, having an efficient way to determine whether a teacher is highly qualified is something brand new that we didn't anticipate. We would need a technological answer to do that. This person has worked on and off on contracts in our agency since 2001, and we have reached the legal end of our ability to contract for these services, at least with this person. And he now knows our systems in a way that obviously is inside out. He's built half of them. He built our website. He built our licensure inquiry system. He's building our confidential internal system for the discipline information. And this package would be supporting hiring a person in that position. And it doesn't have to be this person, but this person has said to me that if he didn't work here for us as an employee, he would commit to train whoever came in, which is equally valuable to us at this stage in the game. But he's taken us from moving paper around our office to where no paper now moves around our office. All of our files are dealt with electronically. So when the information comes in the door, it is scanned, and our customer service folks and our evaluators are now evaluating licenses 100% from electronic files.
Mr. Representative Jensen.
How's come I can get your stuff electronic?
I'd be happy to deliver it on a CD next year.
You can just send it by email. It's fine, you know. And Mr. Chair,
sir,
is it a possibility that we could, that you'd consider working out as a consultant to the legislature on how to use their thing so they can all go electronic?
Chair Galizio, Representative Jensen, this has been a very painful process. But it's been wonderful. The adaptation in the staff has actually produced an interesting issue, but it's phenomenal. And, you know, I mentioned earlier about that expectation of our licensees are getting faster service. Well, we've noticed the same thing with the folks who work in the office. They used to not mind running across the office and spending half an hour chasing down a piece of paper, and now they're just absolutely irritated if it takes 6 seconds for something to pop up on the screen. So you often wonder how people change, but the part of built into this package actually is some capacity to help us maintain the memory in our machines so that this data can come up quickly, because as you know, a lot of data tends to slow machines down, and that becomes another reality of becoming technologically efficient.
But I
represent Jensen.
I make these comments not for, so much for you as for my colleagues on the committee, as well as in other committees. Our office has gone electronic. In my office has gone electronic, and sometimes I am forced, because I get paper that I have to carry with me, and it bothers me. But I'm delighted to hear that you've made this move, and I can appreciate that it might have been painful for some. I had to consult to find out where I could get a good divorce lawyer, because my staff was about ready to carry it out to that extreme. But it is a much easier way to live, and I do appreciate and applaud your efforts and what you're doing with that. I wish we could go further with it faster. Thank you.
Just as a comment, the Washington legislature was electronic, and they have become to the hearings with their computer, with the bills in it, memo books, and their bill files and everything electronic. So we can migrate out of the dark ages. There is an example to the north of us.
Mm-hmm. There you go. All right, Ms. Chamberlain.
Thank you.
Let's proceed.
All right, next. These are things that we actually have coming up that we'd like to do. We'd like to automate our phone services and catch up on that. Phones are still a way that people want to come into our office for information, and we're not now able to handle that capacity, but we believe we'll be able to develop a package next session that could address that. The research demand capacity also has increased significantly. I'm bragging about licensure being electronic, but discipline is still in the dark ages. We have these gigantic files, and that a lot of that has to do with that information being protected. But now we've figured out a way we can also scan that information and put it in internal files so that they can be protected information, and we have that work to do. And then our final policy package is on office support, and actually Legislative Fiscal helped me work through this proposal. That when we started this process, we only had one person at the front end who was opening mail and doing data input, but now out of necessity, we need two people full-time up front there, and I thought I had a half-time permanent position, and I didn't. And I made that mistake in my request, and Darren and Sean rightfully pointed out that I had a limited duration full-time there. But we keep this person occupied year-round. That was one of the issues, actually, when this position was initially approved for limited duration, is could we keep them busy outside of the busy cycle? And boy, can we. We have several hundred thousand records on microfilm. And what we do when anything slows down at the front end is we have people sitting in a microfilm reader right now and translating these into electronic files. One of the reasons is the microfilm is degrading. And the other reason is it's not helpful to have this wonderful system of being able to do licensure electronically and then still have to run after the microfilm and put it in a fiche reader to read the history on someone who had information come into the office before 2003. So this has been fabulous. Now we can, as anything goes down, they have started to incorporate these thousands and thousands of records. The Secretary of State requires us to keep our records for 100 years. So getting that switched over is... We have a lot of records, in other words. That's what I'm trying to tell you. We're requesting to have this as a full-time position. Actually, if this position is approved, we will then only have two office, one specialist. So that would be considered support staff in our office. And that looks like the end of the show. All right. That's my proposal. Chair Galizio, and
I had a question, and to some extent this might be to Darren as well. When you were talking about that package 101, the system support, and that you've been contracting with an individual for several years who knows very well sort of inside and out, and just hearing you talk about sort of the transition, kind of digitizing everything,
you know, security always becomes an issue. So how do you feel your agency is doing in terms of keeping information secure?
Chair Galizia, members of the committee, I think we're doing extremely well. What we've been doing is paying very close attention to the information that's getting scanned and going into the files. As a public agency, most of the things that come in are public. But we have to be very, very careful, like you said. For example, in a discipline case, it's quite likely that if somebody had to send in a report from a mental health professional, let's say, they'll send it through the mail and it'll come in the front door and it'll get scanned. And what you don't want is you don't want it getting associated in a way that would allow it to become public for any reason, because it's a medical record. And so we've had to work with our front staff to help to recognize those sort of things. So based on that notion, what our technology designer has done is he is developing three layers of security in everybody's licensure file. So the first layer would be what anybody with just the name of the educator and the license could pull up and get the public information on their licensure. The second layer is the semi-public stuff we would consider. In other words, it's public upon request, but there isn't any reason to publish it for no reason. And to get that information, you need the educator's birth date or their last four numbers of their Social Security number. And so my point in that is then employers who are hiring people and have that information on an employment sheet can go in and they can get the educator's letters. They could get a discipline order that may have been issued against that educator, but it's not on the high public level. Then the third layer, which would include the educator's transcripts and other protected information that we have that we aren't by law allowed to release, would be protected by a single individual PIN number. So we've trained staff up front to be very careful about how they classify information. We have quite a business process for how we allow that stuff to be viewed. It gets scanned and then it gets re-reviewed by somebody who assigns it and looks at it quite closely and examines it for quality. So every once in a while, we'll find something that slips through, but it never slips through to all the way to the top level where anybody could just get in. It slips through to the second level, and we're able to find that and get it reassociated back. But we process somewhere close to 300,000 pieces of paper annually, even in our little office, and each one of those pages is looked at individually by a live body. In order to maintain the quality in the files. But I think the system that he's created has been quite good that way.
He's going away.
Well, he's promised that he'd help me make any transition if he doesn't stay, if you approve this even at least another year. So I think he's as eager as we are to see some of the projects we've started completed. I don't have any promises from him, in other words, I have to say publicly, but I'm very hopeful.
Okay. Are there any other questions on? Oh, Senator Walker.
Question. Thank you, Ms. Chamberlain. There are, as you know, a host of crimes that teachers can have their license taken from them for. Is the time come for us to review that list to make sure that some of those crimes maybe don't need to be on there and some others should be included?
Chair Galizio and Senator Walker, yes, I think it's time to review that list. I think there are a few that need to be reviewed and may come off that list. Not very many. Most of them are fairly bad. I think there's a few that I would question. But there is a very big list of crimes between what I would consider the bottom of that list and non-criminal behavior. So, for example, our list doesn't include anything related to a federal drug charge. And we had an incident where a candidate had several federal drug charges against them and was doing a student teaching experience in their community, and a community representative knew this person had a criminal past and wondered what this person was doing in the classroom. Well, there wasn't it wasn't a mandatory crime, and they were student teaching. They weren't teaching, and they had had their fingerprints cleared through the Department of Education, which we've closed that loop. We now look at all the student teachers. But I looked at the list, and even though this person had several felonies and misdemeanors, there was nothing that prevented the ODE from saying, the only time ODE can deny somebody the ability to go into a school building is if they've been convicted of one of those crimes. They have no discretion below that. We have discretion below that, but we have to be aware of it. And I think that there needs to be a little more clarity about some of that and looking at some of the crimes.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, the reason I ask that is Senator Carter is trying again for the second session to allow a teacher who was convicted in their youth of prostitution, a person who was convicted of prostitution, be able to apply for a teaching license, because currently it's one of the crimes that is not allowed. And, you know, Senator Carter has presented a very compelling argument about why we should practice forgiveness on this particular crime in these particular circumstances. So the bill's up again on the Senate floor very soon. But when we had the bill presented in committee, I began to think that maybe it's time that we reviewed this list. We added some things. We took a look at what we have here. Because sometimes people do make mistakes in their youth, and they certainly should be given a second opportunity. So I don't know. That might be a project that I could take up in the policy committee, should I be given that chair position in the interim. And if you're willing, I think we'll do that.
Thank you, Senator.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions or issues for Ms. Chamberlain?
Since we're taking some, I find a number of licenses here, active license list, to be kind of interesting. Figures sometimes interest me. But I find it interesting that we have more administrative licenses than we have either or all told school counselors or school psychologists or school nurses by almost a 5-to-1 ratio. That's not quite accurate, but at least a 4-to-1 ratio. For school counselors, 843 licenses to school counselors in the state. What does that come out to be? Something in the neighborhood of one counselor for every 650 plus or minus change students?
Chair Palizio, Representative Jensen, if I may. The figures are a little deceptive in that the personnel service licenses are the former school counseling and school psychology licenses that were issued prior to 1999, and that's the license, and you don't see the school counseling endorsement. So by the same ratio here, where we have about 200 school psychologists to 800 school counselors, about 1,000 of these personnel service licenses are counselors. So that you would add the 843 to the portion of these personnel service licenses here.
So the administration is 2-to-1 instead of 4-to-1.
Yes, it is.
And if I may, just a point of curiosity, are the psychologists, are these licensed psychologists, are these PhD psychologists, or do you know?
Chair Galizio, Representative Jensen, some of them have PhDs, but they only need to have a master's degree in order to get these. And these folks actually work primarily with special ed students and do testing and that sort of thing.
And one other question.
Sure.
On
Representative Jensen.
In relationship to the school nurses, are these principally located in those schools that have the school or have the nursing clinic in their school, or are they, is there some other way arrangement where some of them are at? There aren't enough of them to mount anything in terms of the whole scheme of students, but
Chair Galizia, Representative Jensen, this is my least understood area of why this is at TSPC's office, because there is somebody decided we needed to give certification to school nurses, because I think when this was passed over 20 years ago, they had people who weren't fully licensed as nurses who were acting as school nurses, and they wanted to be sure they were. So my point in saying that is that anybody who's licensed by the Board of Nursing could go in and do the same thing that school nurses do, and I don't really truthfully understand the real value of being certified by TSPC as a school nurse. And there is some mention in our rules that they should be related to a school health center, but they don't have to be, and I can't tell you in all honesty where these folks are employed. I can go look. I could find out by looking.
I suspect that some of the reason might be that you do more of a background check than maybe would have to be in order to be a registered nurse.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
That's
all right.
Any other?
Thank you. Mr. Willie, I tried to get a bill off the Senate floor in the last couple of days, increasing the licensure requirements for charter schools from 50% to a mere 65%. Somehow, Oregonians care a lot about public schools and holding teachers to a high standard and requiring licensure, but we have a little bit less of a demand, it appears, for the same requirements for charter schools. So let me ask you this question. What jurisdiction do you have over teachers and non-teachers in a charter school?
Chair Galizia, Senator Walker, we don't have very much jurisdiction over charter school registrants. The statute was set up that way. In fact, our fee to register them is really, in the past, has been equal to whatever our fingerprint fee has been, because there isn't any evaluation that we need to do. We've basically been a clearinghouse to view fingerprints. The way the statutes were written were very interesting, however. The only time the commission can deny a charter school registration is if an applicant has been convicted of one of those crimes we were talking about that are fairly serious. If they have any other misbehavior, if you will, on their record, there's no commission jurisdiction to do anything about it, including if they came in from another state, for example, and they had been a licensed educator and had been disciplined in that state. We have no authority to take action against them. Only if they are convicted of what we call the mandatory crimes, where it's mandatory, we deny. And we don't have any authority to look at their credentials, and that's left up to the buildings and districts that the schools that hire them.
So, Ms. Chair, if I could follow up, I'm just sort of stinging from that the other day, and I just want to sort of talk about it a little bit. From your comments just now, a teacher from San Antonio who had been severely disciplined for whatever, but it didn't meet any of the crimes that we have listed, could come here to Oregon and teach in a charter school, and no one would be the wiser, no one has any jurisdiction or anything to say about that.
Chair Galizia, Senator Walker, it's so interesting that you say that, because as just half an hour before I came to this hearing, one of the folks working in the investigation area came into my office, and we had an application from an applicant who had been disciplined in a nearby state and had decided not to comply with the terms of the order. And one of the orders was that they be reviewed for some psychological issue. That's often either substance abuse or possible anger management. The other state required a psychological review. And this educator decided to skip out rather than comply with that order and is now working in a charter school. That just coincidentally was the set of facts that came up today. It is the first one I've seen that I've known of, because with 150 population, you're not going to have, if the percentage of folks in that population is the same as teachers, is about 0.3% of folks we discipline ultimately. So the question was, because the only reason I know about this is the person also applied for teacher licensure and had to disclose, and we go to the National Registry and we found out that they had been disciplined, and we call the other state and we get the order, and then we found out subsequently that they hadn't complied, and now we have this whole issue. The question was, do we recommend them for licensure? No. Why would we? The person has given us a lot of evidence, number one, that they're not straightforward with this sort of thing, and we'd certainly want them to comply with the other state's requirements before we would consider licensing them. So it was the first instance I've seen, but it actually, the person is employed, legally employed, by the way, I don't want to mislead you in any way, is legally employed to be in a charter school.
Mr. Chair, I think I've made my case. I certainly wish that I had that little piece of information maybe earlier this week, but it just illustrates the problem, and it illustrates why we have the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, why it's important, and I think it should cover all of our children in school, whether they're in public school or charter school or private school, and I'm just really, really dismayed that we have not found it to be a priority, because that, I mean, Ms. Chamberlain has just made my case.
Thank you, Senator. So if there are no other questions, so tomorrow we have the work session for this, and there, before we leave, actually, two things. Number one is I just wanted to mention, or at least one thing I'm contemplating as we move forward here with in the waning days of the session, I hope, is to perhaps look at some of the bigger issues of the budgets that we have left, and maybe put together some small work groups of folks who could delve into some of the specifics of some of the issues in either the higher ed budget or the community college budget.
Johnson and I would be glad to.
All right, well, we might take you up. So I'm not going to sort of assign anyone today or ask for today. No, not at all. Believe me, I appreciate the volunteering. I just wanted to see if I
could.
No. I think it would be useful just on certain issues. So I don't have specifics right now, but hope that we can do that. And then the second thing is I wanted to turn it over to Steve to talk about sort of calendar, what we're looking at in terms of the next month or so. And Ms. Chamberlain, I wanted to say thank you very much.
Thank you.
And
I
appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we'll be doing this tomorrow.
This is going to be exciting. Mm-hmm. Okay. Huh? There's an end to all of this, I see.
I think the key predicate is, although this schedule is subject to change, that's a pretty important. Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Yeah.
I just wanted to give, and the chair asked me to distribute this information to you, to give you some idea as to the workload that the committee will be looking at over the next few weeks. Actually, in order to meet the schedule that the co-chairs have set out to enable the session to successfully complete as planned, this subcommittee is being asked to work all of the remaining operating budget bills out over the next 4 weeks. So, as the chair mentioned, the rest of this week will be dedicated to Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. But as you can see there, the following week, that's the first week, 14th through 17th, that's next week, we're probably going to be scheduling work sessions on the Department of Education's budget, the operations and grant and aid. That's the operations of the department itself and the programs that it operates. Then during the week after that, we'll be scheduled the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, the State School Fund and the School Improvement Fund. The week following that would be the Department of Higher Education, and then the first week in June would be the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. This would meet the requirements to complete work on the operating budgets by the first week in June.
Senator Walker.
When are we mixing any of the policy bills in here?
I'm glad you asked that question. I was going to ask a similar question.
The policy bills are typically assigned after the subcommittee completes work on the budgets. The budgets are the top priority to get these bills out. Then these co-chairs may assign some of the policy bills before all of these budgets are out, but I would expect that the large majority of them would be after the work is completed on the week of June 7th, 4th through 7th.
Okay.
Thank you for that question.
This last session, we didn't have an opportunity to do it the normal way because Ways and Means was split, and I did not serve in Ways and Means prior to last session, so I'm not even knowing how it all works.
I think there are people who have been here for decades. They're still trying to figure it out. Representative Jensen?
Morgan. I'm sorry.
This is an extremely ambitious schedule, and basically the week of the 21st to the 24th, we've got Student Assistance Commission, State School Fund, and School Improvement Fund, three major policy bills, so it looks like one a day there. And what I'm curious about is, I'm assuming that you have reached a consensus on where you're going to go with these budgets and what they're going to look like in work session, and I'm wondering if you will give us that information so that we can all take a look at it.
I think your assumption is not correct.
I think that, Mr. Chair, is why you suggested that we have little work groups.
Right, and I realistically, I do think that information coming in the next week or so in terms of where we stand as a state is going to have some impact. And then
it's kind of confusing to me then, because you say that you want us to go into some kind of work groups. What exactly are you looking at here in terms of work groups and products and timelines? And
sure. Well, first I wanted to even get a sense of whether people were amenable to that. So I didn't get any extraordinarily negative reactions. So that's great. That's exciting. But for example,
you have your committee here.
I know. Well, that's also a major advantage. advantage of being the chair of this committee. So there are issues, sort of pick your budget, where theoretically we could be talking about for quite some time and go into a great deal of depth. So, whether it's the shared responsibility model and actually how it functions and sort of the hydraulics of that, and some of the healthcare initiatives and the community college and workforce training budget. I mean, some of the things that we have heard about and gone over, but there's so much information that we have to try to process as legislators. I just think there are some issues that we can go into depth, and if we had a couple of people or three people go off into and meet and talk with folks in this building who are experts and had a conversation and then could come back with some recommendations, and these are some things that we need to look at when we're making a decision. That's the idea.
Okay.
In other words, I'm not saying that people will come back and say, okay, this is what you're going to do, and it's done. But just, what are the issues that we need to consider when we're making a decision, et cetera. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr.
I call you Representative Morgan.
That's fine.
All right.
I mean, let's change sides.
Yeah. I just am curious if there's any any hidden message. And the Community College and Workforce Development being June 4 to 7 at the end, I'm wondering if it looks to me like if we adequately fund the above budgets, there won't be any money left by the time we get there, and therefore we can just close all the community colleges and workforce development plants down. I'm hoping that that isn't a hidden message.
Yeah, Representative, if it's hidden, I would, to my knowledge, that's not the reasoning to place that there. And the chair would not allow that to happen, because the chair would then have no job.
Is there a reason, Mr. Chair, why the pieces are put in this order?
Steve? Well, I believe that when we were putting these together, we were trying to put them together in a way that gave staff sufficient time to get the information to the committee that it needed, and also allowed the committee to work this through in a logical manner. There would probably be some ability to change some of that at this point, but it does seem that the order is not significant in any sense, such as Representative Jensen was concerned about. That certainly was not the intent in putting the order together as it is presented to you.
Yeah, and I would just say, again, first time being on Ways and Means and in this position, I've worked with Steve and Darren looking at past sessions and just some of the considerations, but the biggest challenge, it's a big challenge because we have a very ambitious timeline this entire session, but in terms of specifically why this is, it's just how many days is it going to take us, and what do we need to get through, and we have like 1 minute, and I wanted to make sure Senator Morse had a question or a comment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe some clarification of the meaning of words, work and decisions. What does it mean for us to work the budget, and what latitude do we have with respect to decisions?
Well, I think it's going to be dependent on, each specific budget. We have the co-chair's budget, the governor's budget, and we have some degree of latitude. For example, although some folks on the dais voted against the Oregon Health Sciences University budget, it seemed like some degree of consensus that we should move money over to AHEC, because that was one of the university's priorities, and people on this committee thought that that was something that we should do, so we did that. I don't know how I would even be able to articulate specific, I can't quantify what the latitude is or how much discretion we have, but it's our job to work them and have to find some degree of consensus. So I don't know that I can really articulate clearly or quantify that. We have a role to play and an input, and it's going to be important, and my hope is that we can have as much consensus and agreement as possible. Oh, look, it's 4 o'clock. Yeah, so we can continue this conversation offline. All right, so with that, I'm going to close the committee. No, hey, I'm available all day. Thank you very much.